This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Andy Boyd. Today, I'm talking with Mikkel Maher about his book, Six Plays. Mikkel, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Andy.
I was very delighted when I reached out to you. I'd reached out about a somewhat earlier book, and you told me that you'd published this big volume of six plays, and that was great news for me. It was a real pleasure reading the book, and it's very cool to kind of see your work collected from the whole span of your career in one volume.
Yeah, it is. It is cool. It's plays over 20 years, so it was nice to see them all in one handy book.
How do you think your style has evolved over those 20 years?
That's a difficult question because I'm probably the worst person to talk about what my plays are and how other people see them. But from the inside, it always feels like I'm writing the same play. Mm-hmm. I think Robert Altman had that great phrase that it's all one movie. All of his movies are just one movie. And that's the way I've felt that I've had some departures, but where I've just needed to take a break from my particular concerns and obsessions and written different things. But the plays in this volume feel all of a piece to me. They all seem centered on many of the same questions. And the writing style or voice that I discovered for myself sometime in the 90s is just the same one. And though there's obviously the plays are different, they have different characters, they have different stories. The evolution of that style, I always feel like I'm starting from scratch with the same very limited set of tools. So from my perspective, I'm still that same playwright who's trying to figure out the first play in the volume, the fastest play, and then the most recent one, It Is Magic. I feel I'm the same person, which is not always a good feeling, but that's the truth.
Yeah, if I were to sort of venture what some of the common elements are, your plays always or almost always are in a explicit conversation with another, either literary or pop culture or theatrical work.
Yeah.
And they're often written in one long scene. That's not true of every play in this volume, but almost all of them are written in that kind of continuous scroll.
Yeah.
Is there anything in particular that you kind of enjoy about both of those things, about work that is very much in conversation with another work and also that kind of sense of a sort of continuous present?
You know, you've hit on the big question. Enjoy is probably the wrong word. It's more like a necessary for me. I necessarily need to have a sort of an established work, a classic, if you will, work to bounce ideas off of and have it present in the room with me. That's just, I found a long time ago, that's just something that I needed to make a piece go. And again, talking about those, that very limited tool set that I have, that's just it's what I begin with. That's the only way I can start getting ideas and characters down onto the page is to bring in another writer's voice and work that's already been sort of chewed up and digested by the culture at large. The one long sort of continuous, you know, single action. It's not enjoyable. It's easier for me to coordinate all the thoughts in my head. If I'm saying we're just going to stay in one room, mm-hmm. So we're just going to stay in one place and keep exits and entrances to a minimum. And coordinate the ideas, that often conflicting ideas and conflicting themes in that way. It's just simpler to set one table than and arrange the flowers on one table in one bouquet mm-hmm. than it is to try to manage an entire mansion or what have you. So it's again a symptom of how my brain works.
Now, this is so interesting to me that you several times in your answer kind of push back on the idea of you writing this way because you like it. Because to me, I don't know, reading these plays, it seemed like you were having a great time. I mean, I love writing, and it seemed like you were that kind of writer that, you know, you were sitting down and, you know, hanging out with these great works that you admire and that you find inspiration in. And, you know, yeah. I mean, Spirits to Enforce, just to take a relatively random example, it seems to be largely about how The Tempest is so good and people should talk about that more, you know, like there's a real sense of like joy and delight. And you seem to love being a playwright. Is that not true?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, when I get to those moments that you're reading, I feel a great pleasure. I think most playwrights do. When you get to that scene where you feel that's what I wanted. And that's what I wanted to say, but it just takes a long time to get there. And Spirits to Enforce, just to take that as an example, it's a play with 12 people all talking at the same time, trying to put up a production of The Tempest. And it turns out that they're, whatever, it's too complicated to go into, and I'm terrible at synopsizing my own plays. But suffice it to say, it's an extremely complicated work. So just arranging all those characters on stage, and it was at the time my son had just been born, so he wasn't sleeping through the night. So I was writing that, and I was also doing a translation of Cyrano at the same time. So believe me, I remember those moments mostly as lying on the couch, completely sleep deprived, trying to wrestle my brain into a coherent, some sort of coherent pattern. And mm-hmm. when it resolved itself, when all the things came together, or at least to my satisfaction, yes, incredible fun. And the final scene of that, I just remember writing on my couch and just in one rush, but it just took months to get to that place where you could just make it seem where it was easy, where the words were just coming out. But before that, it's inside of my head, it's a really cluttered space. It's not a pretty sight. It's not where you want to be most of the time. And that's what I think most playwrights deal with, is that you just don't have, you have a very cluttered space in your head. If you're saying anything interesting at all, you're plowing your way through the confusion of the world and your own confusion about the confusion of the world, and trying to make something on stage that exhibits some containment of that chaos without completely castrating that chaos, mm-hmm. or whatever the word is.
Sure.
De-energizing that chaos. I'm not an unhappy person, but I'm sorry to say it takes way more effort than it would seem to make those plays, and I'm not just sitting down with a song in my heart every time. In fact, it's quite the opposite.
I'd like to talk more about Spirits to Enforce. I really love that play, and part of the premise of the play is that it's a bunch of people doing fundraising calls to get funding to do a production of The Tempest, but they are also superheroes. And the sort of premise is they're going to use their superheroic abilities to stage this incredible production that sort of fully realizes all the stage magic that you might expect in a really great production of The Tempest.
Right.
I was wondering, reading that play, if part of what it was about for you was this like idea that people are always expecting theater to be saving the world in some way. And so it's sort of a literalization of that. It's like, if the people who are actually saving the world decided to make theater, the rest of us would be rightly sort of upset at them for doing that, you know? Like, we would like the firefighters to be fighting fires, not...
Yeah, exactly. That's a know, really
producing
good way
Kiss Me, Kate.
I'm going to steal that. That's a good way of thinking about that play. Also, importantly in that play, that the superheroes are actually the spirits from the island of the Tempest that beset the characters in that play, The Tempest. So 400 years later, after Prospero has left, Ariel and Caliban have sort of been have taken over the island, and Ariel is sort of the head of the superheroes. And Caliban is, of course, the sort of Lex Luthor, and has sort of, you know, so that's who they're battling. So that was the extra complexity in that play that I discovered midway through it. Before, it was just superheroes putting up a production of The Tempest because that was funny to me. It became more important to me when I realized, oh, they have this, you know, this loss in their life. They wish the world was like it was back in Prospero's time before he left the island. But it took me a long time to get through that. That play was originally just this one-off. It was a commission from this summer camp in New Hampshire, who every summer they bring kids up there and they do theater with those kids, but they ask a working playwright and working directors to work on a particular theme and write a play for 18 characters around that theme. So I wrote the theme that year was superheroes. I had to do 18 characters. And so I wrote this very short play. That was the first version of this, but it was just a bunch of 18 goofy superheroes trying to tell a fundraise for a production of The Tempest. It didn't make much sense.
did the kids like it?
I don't think they did. I wasn't there, but years later, I ran into some years later. I unfortunately, some counselor at the camp thought it would be a good idea to clue me into some Reddit stream or some Facebook stream where the kids now grown up, 30 years old or whatever they were all talking about that weird play that they did. And I was like, oh, this is going to be great. They all had bad memories of it. It was just terrible. There's like, what, you know, that was just a terrible thing. But it was like the worst review I ever received in my life. But it wasn't a very good play at that time. Then I took that version and with my company here in Chicago Theater Oobleck, I struggled with it and made it better.
One of the things that seemed to be giving you some pleasure in the writing of this play is coming up with superhero names.
Yeah.
And I'd like to read a few. The Silhouette. Uh-huh. Fragrance Fellow, the Untangler, and my favorite, the Snow Heavy Branch. What's your favorite of the
Snow Heavy Branch?
That's the one. That's good.
He actually has the smallest, fewest number of lines. I figured, give the character with the best name the fewest number of lines. That was apparently my big idea.
So you mentioned Theater Oobleck, and you've been working with Theater Oobleck for this entire period. I think all of these plays were originally Theater Oobleck plays, right? How did that company come about, and how did you start? Were you a playwright, and then you started the company, or what was the timeline of that process?
Yeah, the core group of us met in Ann Arbor when we were students at the University of Michigan, mostly in the residential college within the larger university. We're most of us members of the Breck Company there, and we're doing our own sort of open mic poetry and performance stuff. And a couple of the members of our sort of group, of our clique or whatever, our little group of poets and theater artists and what have yous, launched the idea of having a theater company called Streetlight Theater. And the idea was that you could perform anything under a streetlight, you know, or anywhere. You could perform anywhere with bare bones. And so that was the launch of a, sort of the company at that point. And we moved to Chicago in the late 80s, 88 and 89, and changed our name because at that time there was like Street Lamp Theater and Northlight Theater and a lot of other theaters with a similar name. So we changed our name to Theater Ubleck. And that was in 88. And we've just been going strong since. You know, we're well over 30 years old now. We've mostly survived just by being very small and not having a huge, we don't have seasons. We don't have any ambitions to expand or grow or, you know, get a big building. We don't even have, we're not beholden to a subscriber base to have seasons every year. So yeah, it's been a real fortunate blessing in my life to have a company, not only of committed theater makers, but just by chance, just the actors in the company, two in particular, Diana Slickman and Cullen O'Reilly, just happened to be the perfect actors for my work. And I don't know how I could be so fortunate in having that, but it is, I write for their voices. They understand immediately what I'm after. And I can't recommend it more highly than to find someone in your life who's an actor who understands your work and you can write for them. And it's extremely gratifying. So that's one of the strengths is that we've just, actors and writers have found each other and put up plays and they seem to work just fine.
What share of the plays that Theater Ubleck does are the plays that you write?
At this point, because of COVID, we're kind of in hiatus, and it's varied over the years. So, you know, that's a difficult question because over 30 years, I'd have to go back and sort of do the percentages. So at this point, we don't really have a season, but more recently, I would say, you know, I would write a third of the things that we would do, whether they're plays or larger projects. We had a 10-year project called Baudelaire in a Box where members of the company were translating all the poems of Baudelaire's Flowers of Evil and then doling them out to different composers and musicians and singers to write songs based on them. So we had French and Spanish and Portuguese and English translations Portuguese, English, and Spanish translations of Baudelaire's work. And then over 10 years, it's about 120 poems. There was a song cycle that we delivered over 10 years. And that was a huge thing culminating about 5 years ago in a huge weekend of all those artists coming in from Puerto Rico, coming in from different states in the U.S., and performing all 120 songs, and it was amazing. So that sort of thing was completely eclipsed anything that I was doing at the time. But you know, I've sort of steadily, you know, before COVID, I was giving out a play every 2 years or so, every 2 or 3 years, and I would come up with something, and we'd do it. But in between those times, there was a lot of other work being done.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that Theater Ubleck doesn't use a director. Is that true?
That is true, yeah.
And how does that work?
So that came out, again, from those early Ann Arbor days when we were all politically active and, you know, against the Reagan administration and going to a lot of political protests and political action committees groups that were working on a consensus basis. So it was all very, very democratic. So you wouldn't have a leader in your political protest. We began to question the idea of having a director or leader in the company itself. And we were interested in different ideas of anarchism and different ideas of radical democracy. So the first time I wrote a full-length play, and it was the first full-length play that the company had done or attempted to do, I came into that first reading of that, and I said, I'd like to really structure this without a director and see what come up with a system to see if we can manage this large play, overly written long play, through consensus, through facilitators, through group process. And we had a couple of tenets. One being that something called actor's prerogative. That means the actor being the person who has to sell to persuade the audience of the worth of the words or the actions that they're doing. They're sort of they're the tip of the spear, right? So they have to be given sort of the ultimate say in how and what they say. So actor's prerogative meant that if they didn't like a line, they could change it, they could cut it, they could rewrite it, whatever. And that would go for anything. So if they didn't like a particular action, they didn't like blocking, they could change it. The playwright would be there to try to lobby for their own words or to get into the discussion. But in the end, it wouldn't be a director or a playwright stepping in saying, you do it this way. It would be the actor saying, look, this is how I think it should be done. And they do it. So that power dynamic was a little different. And it was all very from a sort of a lefty idealistic political origin. When we actually went into rehearsals, it was a disaster. nobody was learning their lines. Blocking was a mess. And we got to dress rehearsal of that night. This is back in 1984, 83, somewhere like that. And we're in dress rehearsal, and it's an absolute disaster. The overly long play that I had written was way too long, and people didn't know their lines. And it was just this total train wreck of a dress rehearsal, way beyond the idea that a good dress rehearsal means a bad dress rehearsal means a good opening night. We knew it was a disaster. So we go through this terrible run through, and then we sit down in a circle to do notes as we, again, an overly long note session is going to be upon us. And we're just all dreading this. And we're sitting in a circle beginning to do the consensus note taking and giving and blah, blah, blah. And David Isaacson, who is one of the founders of our company, who's the most peaceful guy, the most diplomatic person, the most, you know, the most sort of the nicest guy in the group, is the last person to bark out commands or be adamant in his opinions. Before anybody can say anything, David says, okay, we're going to take a 15-minute break. Then we're going to come back and we're going to run it again. And nobody questioned it. Nobody said, no, I've got lots of notes. We just got up and we ran the whole thing again. And it was better. And then opening night was great. And at that point, it became less of an ideological way of thinking about doing theater. And it became an aesthetic. It became more like a jazz band or something akin to that. A collaborative process that is chaotic, but believes in the organic whole, and out comes something in the end that is sort of deliciously, ridiculously, haphazardly chaotic. For a playwright, it's really helped me because I really have to go into rehearsals and go into those first readings and all of rehearsals with the attitude that my work really has to persuade the actors who are performing it, that mm-hmm. the actors really have to believe absolutely in the words, and there's no excuse for either of us. If they're not feeling it, if they're not feeling the language, they can't just grouse about it behind my back and be like, Mikkel's a terrible playwright. And you know, they really have to confront me and say, look, this is why it's not working. I really want this to change. Here's my suggestion, et cetera, et cetera. So there's no buffer between me and the person who's trying to deliver my words. I've worked as a director. I have some of my best friends are directors, and I've worked with other theater companies, many companies around the country, and worked with directors on new work. And it's been a really great process. But it is a fact that those directors often act as a nice buffer between you and the ensemble, that there's no sort of direct notes that you give to the actors. The actors don't give direct notes to you. It's this sort of through this middle person. And mm-hmm. that can be very comforting, and it sort of keeps everybody on an even keel, and there's less I don't know, there's less botheration or less arguments or whatever. I mean, it obviously varies from case to case, but it does, I find as a playwright, it does put me in a position of I'm sort of sitting in the back row of the theater, sort of watching my work develop, and I'm not in the process in the same way as I am with an Ublek show. So I think there's risks and benefits to both ways of doing it, but for better or ill, I prefer the Ublek way, or it's hard, but it's where I've done my most dynamic work.
So you mentioned that you've kind of worked around the country, you've done things at other theaters, but you do have kind of a home-based theater in Chicago with Theater Ublek.
Yeah.
What do you like about making work in Chicago?
Ooh, that's a great, I was going to say, that's a great question, but that's become such a cliche. It's just basically a way to say, I'm not quite sure how to answer that.
Yeah, let me stall for a couple of seconds.
Well, I'm from Michigan, and most of the company is from the Midwest. When we moved to Chicago, there wasn't any doubt about it. We weren't going to move to New York. We weren't going to move to Detroit. Chicago just seemed like the natural choice. It just seemed like that's our city. That's our Midwest. That's our place. And when we arrived here, it really did. It just felt like home. And I was just talking about this with a theater historian here, Mark Larson, who's written this great book on the oral history of Chicago theater, and saying around this maybe gets into too many weeds for you out there or for your listeners. But in Chicago, there was this time between 88 and roughly 88 and 91, these 3 years where a number of theater companies with similar sensibilities all formed at the same time. So Greg Kotis, who wrote You're in Town, was just freshly out of college with his group. He had formed this group called Cardiff Giant, and they were doing shows right around from Theater Ublek, right around the corner from us, and original work, hilarious work. We loved their shows. They came to our shows. Later, the Neo-Futurarium, the Neo-Futurists were launched around the same time. Greg became part of their groups, as did many of his compatriots, many of the people that we work with. The Neo-Futurists are still running strong. Their show, 30 Plays in 60 Minutes, is in New York, is in San Francisco, is in Chicago, has been a mainstay for over 30 years. And there's something about the performance style of those companies, as well as Looking Glass Theater, Mary Zimmerman's company, and especially Mary Zimmerman's plays, that are very, there's something that feels very of a piece that's hard to put your finger on. It is informal, but very intimate towards the audience, very warm and welcoming to the audience. At the same time, it's not just silly camp. It's irreverent, but it's not campy. It's literary, but not obscure or arcane. We're trying to get words around this at this point. The people in this group is that there was this cluster of companies that formed an aesthetic that was kind of a counter to the Steppenwolf aesthetic. The Steppenwolf was, you know, a great theater, but they had established themselves as the theater, and it took a long time for I hope you'll forgive me for New York to understand that Chicago was more than just Steppenwolf, that we could do things that were not strictly straightforward realism. As exciting as that stuff was coming out of Steppenwolf.
Or different from like David Mamet. I think that's the other Chicago thing that people think of.
Yeah. So that aesthetic was so in the late 80s, I think there was people coming to town like my group and other groups, young strivers, who were first of all saying, well, we can't be John Malkovich. We're not that good. Or we can't do that particular thing. We can't be David Mamet. We can't do Steppenwolf and that sort of tradition and that. What can we do? We can do something different. And we did. And I think that's a pretty common story that the young up and comers just try to add to the conversation by doing something opposite or completely different to what has become the establishment. Mm-hmm. So what was the question? Oh, yeah. What makes this a Chicago? So there is, I would claim that there is a Chicago aesthetic that came, that was different than the Steppenwolf aesthetic, that is not as famous or not as well known. But I think if you've seen any Mary Zimmerman's work, I think it's very much of a piece with that. And it does also come out of our tradition of improvisation and us being the improv capital of the country. Mm-hmm. There's that sort of threading into things. Not that any of us were improv, but that when you come to Chicago as a young theater maker, you go see the Steppenwolf shows, but you also then go to the free Second City shows that are 11 o'clock at night. And I remember going there in 88, 89 and seeing a young Mike Myers, just, you know, before he was Mike Myers, and others just completely ripping it up and being amazing on stage. And so you're sort of catching both of those influences and trying to make something yourself that can participate and not imitate. Mm-hmm.
And there does seem to be a sort of intimacy and informality that makes sense when you think about a theater like Theater Ublek in conversation with that kind of improv style that people think of so much being in Chicago. Another thing that you said that I thought was interesting is sort of the idea that they're literary, but not, I don't know, for lack of a better word, pretentious, you know, and something that you do in these plays, which I found really lovely, is that, you know, even though they're based on classic canonical works of literature, you don't assume that everyone in the audience has read them or knows what you're talking about, you know, in Hunchback Variations, which is based on, you know, again, hard to describe your plays, but a central conceit of it is that there are two people trying to replicate the maybe unstageable sonic stage direction from a cherry orchard, and you tell people that you situate it in the context, and you know, you read out the stage direction so that people know what you mean. And was that a sort of conscious choice that you made to like say, if I'm going to do plays that are intertextual in this super intense way, I have to like tell people what the original thing is like?
I think you put your finger on it. I think that's what we all try to do to the best of our ability. We're talking about things that may be literary and may be historical or have political complexity to them, but really try to speak to that, you know, to that person who hasn't read that stuff, who doesn't know that stuff, as best you're able. Is that not to drop references that completely, you know, make people feel like they're on the outs and they're not getting it because of there's some joke that they don't get because they didn't read a particular book. So that's a test that every play has to pass, that I have to see the play through the eyes of someone who hasn't read William Blake or hasn't read The Cherry Orchard or hasn't read Macbeth or hasn't read whatever it is that I'm going on about, and really take it from trying to bring them into a world where those texts exist and people talk about them, but that they can catch up to the conversation. So the other thing that Ublek works with is outside eyes. So we, in place of just the ensemble giving notes to each other in a kind of circle jerk, we bring in anybody who wants to come in, and anybody's welcome. And so actors can invite anybody, the playwright can invite anybody, anybody from the ensemble can invite anybody. So it could be the bus driver you met, or your great aunt, or, you know, your 17-year-old nephew or whatever, people that come from all walks of life, and they sit and they watch a rehearsal. Maybe it'll be a full run through, maybe it'll be just a few scenes. And then we give the floor to them and they give notes. And so you're always being checked by, you know, how is the play reading to someone who doesn't know everything, that doesn't know everything that you're trying to reference. So there's that filter that works really well, I think, is just having a, you know, something like an analog of an actual audience coming in and speaking to what their experience of your work is throughout the process.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The first play in the volume is, I'm going to read out the full title, An Apology for the Course and Outcome of Certain Events Delivered by Dr. John Faustus on This, His Final Evening, which was also the first of your plays that I ever encountered.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned that. I want to know how that, so you said you were in high school when you saw that play?
Yes, I did. I think somebody made me read that play in a class at the, at the Cherubs program at Northwestern, which is like
you were in Cherubs. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Years were you? I think they somehow split it into 30 parts or something. They did Spirits, by the way, an hour long version of Spirits.
Oh, cool. I don't think I was there. I think I read it in.
Right.
I don't think I saw a production of it.
Right.
Yeah. But so that play is the earliest in this volume, but it is not your, as you've indicated, not your earliest play by quite some time. What about that play made you think, okay, this is the earliest play that I want to include in this volume of six plays? Do you feel like you kind of figured something out with that play?
Yeah. So briefly in a nutshell, so we come to Chicago in the late 80s, we do a bunch of work. We sort of put ourselves on the map, and then I have a kind of breakdown. And I need to get out. I leave the company and I sort of wander around until and I'm nearly homeless at this point. I'm really, it's not a good situation in the, like around 92, 93. And I realize I need to go back to school. I had dropped out of University of Michigan and I end up at Bennington College. And I'm just there for a couple of years, but in those years I'm getting my undergraduate degree, I'm just working on trying to discover a voice that works for me, that works with the clutter in my head, that tries to figure out how I can write with the enormous amount of confusion that was in my head at the time. And Faustus came out of a course I took with Bill Reichblum around all the Faustus texts, and we were just reading the Goethe and reading the Marlowe and reading the Thomas Mann and other smaller things. And the at the end of the term, we had to come up with a final project. And so I wrote this play and performed it there in the coal cellar of this ancient mansion on the hill. And that was, so that I really marked as my first play that really sort of launched my my adult adventure in playwriting. And everything before then was kind of a run up, but then there was this breakdown, and then out of that breakdown became my so-called mature work, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But Faustus was, that's what brought it all together for me. The writing of that was where I felt, okay, now I have a handle on things. I have that simple toolkit that I can sit down with and make stuff with. That's why it's the first play in the volume.
Yeah.
That's sort of where things began with me.
Yeah. I didn't know that story, but it makes sense. I mean, it's a play that is the main character, the Faustus in that play, is very much, you know, confused and scared and the sort of like pathetic kind of whiny version of Faustus, kind of petulant almost. Was that sort of, I don't know, cathartic for you to perform that, to kind of just put all your anxieties out into the coal cellar of a mansion on the campus of Bennington?
Absolutely. You know, it was a highlight for me to see something or feel something work. And I think that's true of anybody who's trying to make theater. But it was a breakthrough moment for me. But it was even better though, that I came back, I performed it in Chicago in 99, and I rejoined Ublek and sort of then began a more serious endeavor to try to write more plays for Ublek and become a playwright. And that was the first play that sort of put me on the map here or got me more attention here in town. But the great breakthrough was when we remounted it about 8 years after that in 2008. And I realized, oh, I'm not the best person to play this. Cullum O'Reilly is the best person to play this. And he was. And he, so it was that giving over that role that was, as you say, sort of cathartic for me to memorize and rant and rave and perform, that the voice of that character was cathartic for me in the 90s and towards the end of the 90s. But once the aughts came around and I'm really trying to be more of a writer and learn that craft, the just that pivot point of understanding or allowing or releasing that character to somebody else was the great epiphany.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you seem to return to in a bunch of your plays, and starting in the Faustus play, is, well, let me back up. I feel like if you're doing theater that is relatively stripped down in presentation, there's one thing you can do, which is do plays that are about stuff that is very ordinary. You know, they do a kitchen table family argument play and have a kitchen table, and that's all you need because that's the sort of central artifact in this kitchen. Sure. But what you do is often have people describe things that would be impossible to stage and sort of gesture towards the rather creaky representational apparatus of the theater and kind of like remind your audience how bad it is at representing real life. Hmm. Like I'm thinking of in It Is Magic, they're in the bottom floor of a building where the top floor is on fire.
Yeah.
And it's like sort of like you'd love to see that. And it's maybe a light cue where you could distantly see some flames in the background or something. What do you think is interesting to you from a kind of writer's standpoint in plays that sort of confess their own failure in a way?
Geez. Well, I think it's funny, first of all, to confess your failure as an artist.
I think Shakespeare thinks it's funny. Like, I think that's, yeah. I think Shakespeare's doing this all the time. And I think I think part of him is like, oh, it's fun that I'm just going to tell people they're in a forest now and they're going to believe me because I told them.
It's not only, it is fun. I think it's fun with a capital F, don't you? I mean, don't you think it's that trick that all really good players, this is what I teach playwriting now at the University of Chicago. And one of the things I try to drive home to the students is the thing that theater can do, the pleasure that it can offer that I think movies don't, is that it can both bring a very present thing, that kitchen table, onto stage, right? You have a kitchen table, you have a knife, or you have somebody throwing a pot at somebody else, and all that is present action. The thing that is very real and very present in front of the audience's mind, they feel it and they see it and they hear it in real time. There's that power, but equal to that power is the power of playwrights and actors to describe or evoke what is in the wings, what is off stage, to bring into the audience's inner eye or mind's eye something fantastical or something, whatever, real or what have you, very palpable, very graphic, and conjure that in their imagination. And both those things, the very present, the very real, and the distant and invisible, and yet describable, those sort of have an equal power on the stage, and you should be employing both of those powers to the best of your ability. So I like your talk of the real kitchen table, and the power of that I think is obvious. But you just can't forget the great thing that both Shakespeare and the Greeks do, and that is they have a character come in at some point and they describe some horrific murder or a monster coming out of the sea or I'm thinking of Theseus's death in the Bacchae, how well that's described. I mean, it's just that sort of power is what makes theater, to me, the language of theater, vibrant and wonderful and should be employed by all theater makers as mm-hmm. much as possible.
And in the Greek messenger scenes, it's not like a story from long ago. It's like this crazy thing just happened. I need to tell you about it.
Yes. Yeah. And that I find great joy in that. And I think all the playwrights that I really like and enjoy, they just do it in spades. They just do it so well. I don't remember what the question was, Andy. I can't remember if I answered it, but that's the other reason I think for me to keep things in one place, mm-hmm. like establish that one place, that one sort of isolated little simple kitchen table or what have you, and just very minimalist, and everything in that space is real. Everything, there's nothing that's allowed in that that's pretending to be something else. So a chair is a chair, a rug is a rug, a lectern is a lectern, etc. So everything is, there's nothing that's trying to pretend to be something else. But then that for me, that allows a nice platform to spring from to talk about the fantastical outside of that. To bring into that space through language and through imagination, just by saying so, a messenger speech or what have you, just really wonderful and adventurous images and stories that live outside the mundane.
I have a friend, Nora Casey, who took one of your playwriting classes at University of Chicago and loved it and had nothing but good things to say about it. And she said that one of your exercises was, I might be getting this wrong, but something like you asked all the students to try to figure out ways to adapt Frank O'Hara's lunch poems into plays.
Oh, she goes way back. That was a whole class.
That was a whole class.
Yeah, that was my first class that I taught, and it was kind of a disaster. I mean, I just talked to a Eddie DeHaes, who's up at Brown now. They're just getting their MFA in directing. And they just were in town working on some guy's play, and we had coffee, and they told me in no uncertain terms what a disaster that class was. And the students were all huddled after class going, what does he want? What does he want from us? And I was like, I don't know what we were trying to adapt Frank O'Hara's Lunch Poems, which I love. And I thought, this book. I love these poems so much. There must be some way to introduce them to a group of undergraduates, theater students, and we can dig into them and make wonderful theater out of them. And I think I would be interested to know what Nora really thought, but I remember the classes like being really very difficult for people. And so it was never repeated. We never, now I just teach other things, but I would. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So what I'd be interested to hear, like what kind of exercises do you do? Because I thought that, I mean, when I heard that story, I sort of assumed it was like, this is your method, you know? And I got to say, that's a very bold first class, you know?
I just thought it would work to me because I was introduced to Frank O'Hara when I was an undergraduate, and I thought, oh, this is just great. And just was very inspiring to me. So I think I was just going off of that. And I was just like, these poems are so open and personable, mm-hmm. and they're just so, they feel like little plays to me. There's got to be a way to just make them great. And there were some great, great things that, as I remember, there was great things that came out of there, but I really went into it without any preconceptions about what the students should really do. And I didn't really have any real guidelines for them. And I think they really stumbled around just trying their best. I was probably too honest at times and was like, no, that's not really, that doesn't really work, you know, or whatever. And, I would be interested to talk to Nora about her experience. But my methods are pretty straightforward. We read great plays. We read plays that excite me. I never try to assign plays that are just important from a historical perspective or something. I'd really try to, I preface everything by saying, look, the plays that I'm going to ask you to read every week are plays that I read when I am struggling to come up with inspiration. So they're plays that excite me. And so that's, but I have a pretty Catholic taste. I have wide ranging taste.
What are some of the examples?
So anything by Annie Baker, booty candy. Wojciech is a go-to every single. So Wojciech, we do every. Wojciech is out of the gate. Wojciech is like, we're, you know, any translation you guys want to bring in, and we read Wojciech, and I say, this is an example of a 19th century play that wasn't done in its time, but is now done all the time. But it's unfinished. It's out of order. We don't know what its real structure is. It doesn't really seem to have a structure. So why is it this play that still works? And we sort of meditate on that. We sort of try to get to the root of what makes a play work. And that's why I begin with Wojciech. One, for those sort of questions around what makes a play work, but also because I really love it as a play. Mm-hmm. We read, so it'll vary from term to term, but we usually do one Shakespeare and we'll spend 2 weeks on one Shakespeare sort of digging into it. But we'll, you know, so then, but it's just one play a week. Unless it's Shakespeare, then I break it up into two. And then the way I ask students to read it is to read it and then write a brief two or three line essay called What Would I Steal? And that just means have them read the play as you would just read any play, but be aware of the moments that you are leaning in and you find something particularly interesting, a line or a moment in the play that you think is funny or particularly insightful or whatever, that you think it works, and then try to decode that for yourself. Try to put into language what it is that is making that moment work. Not just a sort of thumbs up or thumbs down, but just like, okay, I like this. There's a really funny line. I think it's a funny line to me because of the two lines that preceded it really set it up well, or whatever the case may be. And that's an effort to try to get students to get out of their sort of thumbs up, thumbs down, you know, Roger Ebert kind of view of the arts and just being an audience member, but being an active creator. You have to develop your own personal aesthetic and understand why it is that you like something or don't like something, and try to really come up with rules of thumb around what it is that works for you in a piece. And so that's my main thing, is just trying to get them to look at the great works of literature, but also the literature, the works that their own fellow students are turning out in their own work as well, is to try to look at it with that critical eye of, I like this, but why is it that why do I think that it works? And how can I steal that same mechanism or rule of thumb? How can I steal that for my own work when I'm sitting down in front of the computer or a blank sheet of paper and I've got no ideas? Can I just lift that thing that I like from Shakespeare? Or lift that thing that I like from Annie Baker, or what have you. and then we write a short play over the course of the quarter. The UFC is only 9 weeks long, so there's not much time to write anything much longer than that. But we work on a good solid 10 to 15 minute piece over the course of the term. And by the end of it, they have whether they like the class or not, they come out of it with a play that they've written that has a beginning, middle, and end, and it's something they can, you know, produce themselves, or they can send off, or what have you. But that's important to me as well, is that we use the class as a deadline to get something done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that certainly sounds like a fascinating, very well-ordered class. maybe try the Frank O'Hara thing one more time, though. I don't know. Maybe it was a fluke. I think about I don't remember what poem it's in, but there's a line in one of those poems where he says, I read because I'm a writer, you read for some mysterious reason. And I think about that line once a week at least. It's just such a funny.
I don't know. I don't remember that.
That would be a great line if it were in like a drawing room comedy. You know, like many of the. Yeah. Anyway, this is like the coldest of cold takes, but those lunch poems are very fun and funny and good.
They are. But half of them, what you don't realize is that I didn't really realize this until I got into the class, is that they're very different from, there's half of them are quite personable, quite like that straight, mm-hmm. that Franco Hero voice that feels very intimate, like he's just in the room with you talking. And then there's these other, there's stanzas within those poems that are utterly opaque and completely surreal and come out of his love of surrealism and his love of, I don't know, the imagists and stuff. That is a very sharp contrast to that. And I had no idea what to do with those parts of O'Hara's work to turn those into theater. The other stuff seems very, you know, the one where he feels like a person talking to you feels naturally theatrical, right? It feels like a little play. Then when he wanders off into the stranger stuff, it becomes more difficult. But
that's a lot of what your plays do. Like they feel very conversational, and then they have these sort of these sort of leaps into the stratosphere with these kind of beautiful, amazing kind of feats of language.
Thank you. I feel that they're always tethered, though, to trying to. In contrast to the O'Hara, it just feels they still feel very simple to me, and approachable, even if it's fantastical. But his work does, at points, feels like you're reading Ezra Pound, and you're like, "What?"
Yeah.
And so it's nothing against Ezra Pound, but I don't know how theatrical his poems are.
Well, O'Hara's a New Yorker. Maybe that's the difference. A Chicago, New York thing. Well, Mikkel, it's been such a pleasure talking with you about these plays. I've already taken up a lot of your time, but I just wanted to thank you once again for being on New Books in Performing Arts. And I really encourage anybody who's interested in, you know, discovering more about these plays to get this volume. $20, 6 plays. Great deal.
Such a deal.
Run out and get it, and you won't regret it.
Thanks so much, Andy. It was a real pleasure talking to you. And stay in touch. I'm just tickled that you know Nora and that she she remembered that class apparently with some fondness. Say hi to Nora if you see her.
I will do so.